Disease, they can become so widespread as to transform into movements. AIDS, cancer, heart disease, but many disorders are rare, and the federal government spends considerable resources tracking them too. Dr. Christopher Austin is director of the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences at the National Institutes of Health. NCATS held a symposium on rare diseases earlier this week. Austin explains rarity was defined by the Orphan Disease Act of 1983, which defined it as a disease affecting fewer than 200,000 people in the United States. I asked how many such diseases there are in the first place.
There are estimates between 5,000 and 7,000 rare diseases, and the consensus estimate is around 6,000. You might ask, why is there confusion about how many diseases there are? It really is a definitional question of what can be defined as a disease itself versus a variant of another rare disease. But the point is that there are about 6,000 of those diseases, and the really important number that patients think about is that of those, less than 300 have any FDA-approved treatment.
So this really is an intergovernmental effort to try to find and identify these diseases?
Yes. So one of the things that NCATS is spearheading is an effort to come up with a definitive list of the number of rare diseases that exist. There have been various attempts by various agencies worldwide to define the number of diseases, and they've all done it in a slightly different way. I guess the way to think about this is that like other diseases, common diseases, the definitions of diseases are changing in this day and age from being defined on the basis of symptoms or signs, those being symptom and a sign. A symptom is something that a patient reports. A sign is something that a doctor observes. But initially, diseases were all defined, of course, on the basis of a symptom that a patient had or an examination by a physician, because there were no genes, there were no molecules. And now rare diseases are leading the way in redefining diseases on the basis of molecular pathology, molecular pathogenesis, not simply symptoms and signs.
I guess it's sort of a philosophical question, but if someone has this genetic marker that shows that something is abnormal, but they don't feel anything and it doesn't affect their life, is it, why call it a disease?
Right. So it's a great question. And a very relevant question. So rare diseases are, by and large, genetic. About 80% of them are genetic. There are rare diseases which are not genetic. Probably the most famous of them recently is Ebola, which happily is rare but not genetic. And rare, when we say rare genetic diseases, what we mean is that the gene is affected in a severe way. There is a mutation which causes the gene to not have any function at all, for instance. And those will frequently cause rare diseases. Another kind of defect in the same gene could cause a different disease or could cause no symptoms at all. And we wouldn't characterize that as a disease just for the reason that you state. One of the real challenges, of course, in as a result in defining rare diseases is making a connection between these genetic misspellings of various sorts and the symptoms that they present with. That's one of the issues, one of the efforts that we're engaged in here at NCATS.
We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Austin. He's director of the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences at the National Institutes of Health. And so given the fact that there is a genetic basis to many of the newly discovered rare diseases, I imagine that also means there's a different channel by which that information gets to NIH to be able to investigate to see if it is a rare disease.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting to observe that in the 3 decades since I graduated from medical school, exactly 30 years ago this year, the number of rare diseases, the genetic basis of which we understand, has increased from about 20 to about 5,000 over the last 30 years. So that is an absolutely epical change in our understanding of the molecular basis of rare diseases. However, the treatment of those diseases, most of those diseases, has not kept pace. And so there is a major effort to bring that promise to the patients who are suffering from rare diseases. That said, it's important that patients uniformly feel that a diagnosis alone is an enormously important event in their lives, that rare disease patients frequently feel isolated, feel hopeless, that no one understands their disorder. They tend to go from one doctor to another for an average of 2 to 3 years without a diagnosis, so-called diagnostic odyssey. And the advent of molecular genetic sequencing has begun to short-circuit that process considerably and bring more diagnoses much more quickly to patients who otherwise wouldn't have had them.
What is the process by which NIH takes in the possibility of a disease and then renders it, decides, yes, this is a rare disease?
So there are a number of resources that NIH has. The NCATS itself has something called the Genetic and Rare Disease Database, or GARD, which is really a comprehensive compendium of rare diseases and their molecular causes. To address the kind of uncertainty that exists sometimes between molecular misspellings in a gene and a disease, the National Library of Medicine has something called ClinVar, or Clinical Variation. It's another database, and something called ClinGen, which is Clinical Genetics, which goes into great detail about researchers who have found genetic misspellings and the symptoms and signs that are connected with those, without saying that these things are necessarily diseases, just to say, well, here's an observation, and we're going to report this in hopes that if there are enough such reports, it will become clear that there's a pattern here which represents a disease.
And as communications technologies and the ability to comb through data have advanced along with the knowledge of genetics, I guess that maybe has also enhanced this ability too.
That is the other piece of this, which is very exciting. There are a number of examples now of researchers and even patients who have quickly been able to define either unusual presentations of known diseases or entirely new diseases by connecting with patients in other parts of the world who have similar symptoms. A great example of this is a man named Matt Mite, who had a son born with a rare disease that couldn't be diagnosed. He was found to have a mutation in a particular gene by his doctors in Utah. Matt happens to be a professor of computer science at the University of Utah, so started a social networking effort to find patients like his son, and within a couple of years had found two dozen other patients throughout the world who had similarly been told that no one had ever seen a disorder like this. And very quickly it became evident that there was not one child in the world with this. There were several dozen children with this disorder. And so that headway is made possible by the combination of the kind of genetic sequencing technologies that are available now, plus the ubiquity of the internet.
And just a final question, since it's kind of topic A these days, and that is Zika. I mean, is Zika a disease or an illness? And the symptoms that it, or the conditions that it is purported to produce, which is the small head syndrome, is that a disease? And do we have two rare things going on here?
It's a great question, and it's the effort going on to discover whether the microcephaly, that's the small head syndrome, that's been associated with Zika virus infection is actually caused by Zika virus infection is a typical kind of detective sleuthing problem that one has in rare diseases. The difficulty, of course, with Zika is that one can't diagnose it by sequencing, doing genome sequencing on the patient the way one could in Matt Mite's example, but it's a similar kind of problem. I should also say that something that we have not touched on is the importance of interagency collaboration here. I would say in rare diseases, particularly the very tight and mutually beneficial collaboration that exists between the NIH and the FDA has been absolutely critical over the last 30 years, really, in moving this field forward. There we have very close connections with our colleagues in the Office of New Drugs at CDER, in the Office of Orphan Products Development there, and we really work hand in glove with our colleagues there to move forward both understanding and treatment of rare diseases.